Welcome back to Old Taku no Radio. This is episode 11. I am Jared. I am joined, as always, by Anagamer's chief booze and poetry correspondent, Ink.
Sup.
And with us today is a very special guest. You may have heard of him. I think his name's Evan Minto, who does something important related to Anagamers. I'm not sure. I can't exactly remember. But say hi, Evan.
Hey, what's up? The boss man's here, and it's time for your performance review.
God damn it.
Welcome to the minor leagues.
Yeah, so I'm, for those of you, I guess, who are maybe like hardcore Old Taku no Radio listeners who don't listen to my podcast, I am the editor-in-chief of Anagamers.com and the host of the Anagamers podcast. And Anagamers hosts Old Taku no Radio. It's like a part of the family. I hope I'm a nice boss. I don't really like get in your guys' way very much, I don't think. I kind of just let you do your thing because it's a good show.
No, we don't want to give the impression that Evan comes riding in on a horse demanding his tithe and, you know, or is taken off in a palanquin where he comes and visits us once a month or something. No, that does not happen.
And he hasn't even taken away our funding yet.
Yes.
Although.
Right, the quote funding, unquote.
So today we are here to talk about something that is going to probably twist our tongues in knots because it's sort of the inspiration for the name of our own show, but it is the legendary 1991 2 OAV set Otaku no Video that recently got a revival here of sorts where it was one of the many Animego properties or licenses risen from the grave via Kickstarter, and just kind of came up on our list of things we probably need to cover, so here we are. Ink, tell us a little bit about Otaku no Video and what it's all about.
According to Anime News Network, the complete plot summary is a normal man who slowly slips into the life of being an otaku and never returns.
Hmm.
But it's so much more than that, because it's the journey to become the Oda King from Oda Nothing.
Has one of the greatest intros.
Well, yeah, you'd expect it to. Given the creators. We'll get into that in a little later. But it's literally the journey of one man who has a normal life and by a set of circumstances, you know, encounters an old friend from school who's basically just gone what we know today as the otaku way of life and just obsessed with anime and the other things that his roommates are obsessed with. They all just sort of draw him into this world of deep, deep despair and self-concentration, removing him from the world slowly to the point where his girlfriend dumps him and all he has left is these aspirations to become the Oda King, the biggest geek, the best geek possible, to rule over all geeks.
We're gonna have the biggest geeks, the best geeks.
Oh, God.
No.
Not today, Satan. Not today. It's a very meta set of OABs. And, you know, I think what struck me about it, watching it again, and I have not watched it, you know, I bought it with the Kickstarter, I backed it, and I haven't watched it since, like, it was on VHS, like, back in the, was it 92, 93, somewhere around there, where, like, Animego brought it over. And I remember at the time, you know, I was 13 or 12, and I'm like, okay, this is really fucking weird. Why do I keep, like, interviewing these Japanese dudes? And it's kind of weird. And, like, the videos, like, I didn't appreciate it as much then as I do now. It was kind of like, just, like, get me back to the cartoons back then. And I just kind of, so, yeah, I remember even fast-forwarding through the interviews as I was a kid. So, you know, don't judge me too harshly. But yeah, it's amazing just kind of how, I don't know. I couldn't help but look back at it as a relic or a slice in time in history of otakudom then versus how I think it's perceived now.
I think it's interesting you mentioned that, like, as a kid you were like, oh, get me back to the cartoons, because it's really interesting that it was this otaku thing, this, like, hardcore geek thing, right? All these, like, made by people, as we'll get into, who are really, really into, like, science fiction and stuff, mm-hmm. and about that. But it's, like, very just real life. Like, it has exaggeration to it, but, like, it's interesting to think, because I wasn't around when it kind of first came out, really, or I was not, like, paying attention to anime. I was pretty young.
Mm-hmm.
To think that, like, you know, you've got all these big sci-fi things on the shelf, and then there's this thing that's just takes place in the real world, but it's meta. It's about people who like sci-fi, but it doesn't actually have the sci-fi elements in it, other than, like, at the very, very end, basically,
yeah.
as a joke.
Yeah. Yeah, it's kind of funny, too, because I think the definition of otaku, or the working definition of otaku in Otaku to Video, if you compare it to kind of how people think of it today, at least in the United States, I know Japan might be a little bit different.
Yeah, right.
It's, you know,
super different.
Yeah, it's very, it's much broader, much more open, you know, of an idea of what an otaku is versus what a lot of people perceive it to be here, which is, you know, just a, you know, I'm into anime kind of thing.
I mean, I think that's generally an American and Japanese distinction more so than like a past and present distinction. Mm-hmm. Though obviously the word otaku has changed, I think, a fair amount in Japan. But I mean, like, we use it to refer to Japanese pop culture because it's a Japanese loan word, mm-hmm. and it like wouldn't make a ton of sense to use it if you're really into Bollywood or something, right?
yeah, the rare Bollywood otaku, you know. But to your point, Evan, it does make a lot of sense that you know, in the way that we use it and the way you've just explained it. And I think if, you know, if I look at my own life, I think I fit pretty closely with what the Japanese definition was, at least as it was construed in the anime, right? Like, I like other things besides anime. I know which you know. Dear listeners, I know that might come as a shock, but yeah, like I do. I'm a huge gaming nerd. That's probably a bigger fandom for me than anime, really. You know, I've designed games, I've written games, I've written rules, you know, kind of on an amateur level, kind of like a doujinshi kind of version of the same kind of thing you see in otaku no Video. So I think, yeah, it's in practice, I think, you know, geeky people here in the States do have lots of different interests generally.
Yeah, it's what we'd maybe call geek culture,
right.
In English language circles, right?
Yeah.
I have not watched this since backing the Kickstarter, and I remembered ever since my first watch of this, I remembered the intersplicing of the real world, quote-unquote, interviews, the sort of mockumentary nature of this whole thing, and I didn't realize how well it actually worked. Because it's self-deprecating on a lot of levels, and it's also self-empowering to some point as a fantasy item. But what I completely blanked on was the fact that in between all the segments, like in between the cartoons and the real life, they always gave like a specific point in history. Like,
yep.
This is now where the Lusitania sunk, and it was always like tragedies up until.
Is it all tragedies?
There's only two times that they mention something that's not a tragedy, and I love these people for this. One is they give you the date of like July 1st, 1986 or so, which is when Super Dimensional Fortress Macross the movie, Do You Remember Love, hits the theaters.
Yes!
And then a couple of years after that, again, my heart, I love these people. They like Wings of Onyamas like debuts
their movie.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's like they're giving that the same weight as, you know, like the Falkland Islands are invaded by Great Britain.
Yeah, yeah, because it's a lot of like real world history stuff. Though you could say that maybe the Onyamas release is its own kind of tragedy because the movie bombed.
Well, true enough.
Yeah.
and that goes back to that sort of self deprecation that permeates this work. Like the tone of the whole thing. But I didn't remember that at all, and then in more otaku no Video, all those little placeholders for time and space are no longer tragedies. Now they're positive in some way, and I've forgotten since my rewatch 2 days ago. But I just love the fact that they did that. That was something surprising on this to me.
I think it also just in terms of those like little title cards. They serve to contrast, like, the real world with the otaku world and sort of shows how like, in a bubble all these people are, right? It's like, hey, there's a whole thing going on outside of you.
Yeah.
It's like, there's real world news, there's politics, there's things that aren't just cartoons, right?
Do you think that was on purpose? Like, their way of sort of shaking people and just go, hey, look, these two can coexist.
If it feels to me, and I'm very cynical about this stuff, so I read Otaku no Video as being, at least in part, like a, you know, poking fun, self-deprecating thing, which is not an uncommon reading. To me, it's like, you guys are freaking out about all these cartoons, or like, you know, we, the creators, freak out about these cartoons, but, you know, around this same time, much bigger, more important things were happening in the world than all the stuff that we were obsessed about.
Yeah, I feel the same way, honestly, and I think that there's this interesting sort of tension between the animated scenes and their sort of fever dream, wild, fanciful kind of, you know, storyline in the animated scenes, and then the portrait of an otaku, you know, actual real footage scenes, that there's like this tension between the two. And I feel like those slides that show those world events kind of are sort of an in-between kind of way of making you get ready to transition from one to the other.
Definitely makes it easier.
Yeah.
So what if that was aimed at that generation? How do you think people who have just watched this for the first time would think of it?
Like specifically the title card bits or the OVA as a whole?
The OVA as a whole.
This is where my opinion on the OVA has shifted significantly over the years. I initially, kind of like Jared, I didn't super like it at first. I was like, this doesn't really work. It's really jarring. It's not particularly funny. Right. And nowadays I get a lot of the references, and so I appreciate it a lot more on that level. But like, I think probably it's just a time capsule. Like, I don't know if it actually ages super well, but it's fascinating as a way of capturing what the fandom was like at the time.
That's kind of how I feel about it, too. I think it's a great historical piece now. It's odd to call Otaku no Video a historical piece, but I think it works in that way best at this point in time. And, you know, it is replete with... I mean, I still see things that I didn't see before, I go, oh, God, that's in there. And it's pretty amazing in terms of being... kind of a comprehensive look, like in terms of its references. It's sort of all inclusive of just about everything these guys are into, that, you know, you can assume that a lot of fans like them would have been into at that time. I think part of what will inform somebody's viewing of this, if they're viewing it for the first time, is where they came up in fandom. Like, if they're of an older generation of fandom that can still remember things like love. The guy who tapes, well, love too, obviously. but like the guy with like the vast tape, like he was at the center of this vast taping network where he's getting phone calls and like, oh, God Mars, yeah, I'm on it, here we go. And he's trying to open the package with one hand.
With one hand, yeah.
Which anybody that's tried to open those fucking VCR tape packages like that, that is very hard to do. The fact that the guy even got as far as he did, I'm kind of impressed. You know, to do that, to remember stuff like that. I mean, that's like how I got my, that's, you know, 70, this is kind of like tracing it like terrorist financing, right? But like 70 different layers later, that's how a kid in Alabama got to see, you know, fucking Evangelion, you know, because that was how it was done back in those days. And I think it's kind of nostalgic for me in that sense. I would love to know how a fan, you know, maybe like a sub 25 fan.
Well, you're talking to one who's pretty close. So,
you know, like, I mean, well, what do you think about any of that? Does that make sense to you, Evan? Like the whole generational kind of thing, or?
Well, yeah. I mean, I think that people who grew up with that, that makes sense. For me, like, I didn't grow up with any of that, right? Like, this is going to be interesting being on old Taku no Radio. I don't think I've ever even watched a VHS fan sub ever, right? Like,
yeah.
I certainly did not grow up with them, right? I mean, when I became aware that there was, this is also funny, right? When I became aware that there was anime that wasn't on TV, which is funny, right? Just considering how many fans I think maybe did not get their start in TV.
Yeah, true.
By that point, like, digisubs were really big. like, you know, subs on, like, you know, you'd do, like, torrent subs or whatever,
oh,
right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
So, like, that was how I got introduced to it. So, for me, it's very much seeing what it was like in the before time, right? What people used to do.
Yeah.
And I mean, just for, like, a really, really weird, like, you know, age shock is, like, while Otaku no Video did come out while I was alive, most of the events of the OVA take place before I was born.
Mm. So it's, like... Okay.
Yeah.
It's okay, Evan. You have an old soul, so, that's... you know. Yeah. And you're also... You're also, like, A, really well-informed compared to anyone who's, like, just entering the fandom now.
Yeah. Well, yeah. And two...
But, I mean, what...
I mean, people that are just entering fandom now... Like, I've got little sisters who are in middle school and high school, respectively, through my stepdad. And they didn't even see, like the stuff that you just described, Evan. I think that's yet another slice... in
right,
sort of
right.
intergenerational, like, anime fandom, right? So they have access to every kind of damn streaming service you can imagine, and they can watch anime, you know, hours or days, usually hours after it's aired in Japan. So, like, you know, we're living in this, like, space age.
Yeah, I mean, I've been, not to go too far off topic, but, I mean, I've been talking to people recently. There's a lot of complaints about Netflix and Amazon streaming stuff.
Oh, yeah.
There's going to be a lot of kids who their first anime was, like, Glitter Force or Little Witch Academia on Netflix.
That's right.
Right?
That's right.
And they will later find out that that old TV thing that their parents watch also has anime.
Yeah.
You guys used to have to wait week for week for it?
Right. Yeah, like, for me, it's very much just, like, it's a time capsule. It's, like, opening it up and saying, like, oh, wow, this is how they did it, right? This is where the kind of attitudes and approaches and, like, just sort of fan philosophies, right, like, kind of came from. And seeing that, like, through line to how that ended up informing the way that fans online interact. And also, for me, personally, not as, like, a young person or whatever, but as a just the kind of fan that I am, it's all about connections with real world, like, you know, history of Gainax and things like that. Mm-hmm. Right? And, like, the history of how this industry developed.
Yeah. I think you could make an argument too that, in at least this was on my mind watching it this morning again, was you really see the seeds of modern anime fandom in what you're seeing in Otaku no Video. And I kind of wonder, you know, after the tremendous success that Gainax has had and Toshio Okada kind of being instrumental in so many of these things, and obviously this sort of semi-autobiographical kind of thing that's got, mm-hmm. that kind of runs through the OVAs, you know, it's interesting to see kind of how the culture has evolved from that point in time. And you can really kind of look at this as sort of your proto-culture, slip in another Macross reference.
that's the thing. Like, I'd actually want to see, I'd want to frame this in the fact that, like, maybe this was responsible for people starting to own their otaku nature. Like, not that this is anything, you know, revolutionary in the fact that, oh, I'm an otaku and I'm proud of it, but this is used sort of as an indoctrination by a lot of the fans to other new fans. Like, oh, you've got to check this out. This is, you know, the perfect thing to watch when you're getting into this fandom because it describes us.
Mm.
And, you know, the whole plot of the OVAs are, you know, okay, guy loses this meaningless job that he really didn't even like to begin with, his girlfriend, but he finds power through, you know, the power of this hobby or this obsession. And that's driven, I don't know how much in Japan, but that's definitely had an effect, or that attitude has an effect and is very in place in American fandom. Wave your geek flag proud.
I think it's very different for Japan, but you may be right for America.
Yeah, I think with Japan, like the geekdom kind of movement and the way it's sort of metastasized into this mainstream pop culture thing here, I don't think that's exactly quite the same as it is in Japan. Like, I never got the sense of it. I mean, it's definitely present, and you definitely see it. You don't have to look too hard to find anime and manga if you're just walking the streets of Japan, just like in, you know, anywhere town Japan. But You know, it's not like something that they're talking about on the evening news. It just didn't seem to have the same kind of visibility. Now, granted, back when I was there, you know, the American pop culture fandom, geekdom kind of thing was still, it hadn't quite hit its crescendo yet, but it was, you could see it definitely taking off in that direction. So I think it's definitely kind of more telling for American fandom and more valid, I think, for American fandom that a lot of the attitudes and things that you see in Otaku no Video, you definitely see that, like, in U.S. pop culture. I mean, geekdom is like a multi-million dollar business now, for crying out loud. It's pretty out there, in a way that kind of mimics Otaku no Video, oddly enough. Like, eventually we're going to have, like, a you know, fucking Will Wheaton theme park or some crap, you know? Like, it's, you know, who knows?
It's not, like, and eventually, right? Like, it's just Star Wars.
Well, that's true.
Right?
Yeah.
Star Wars basically has a theme park, right? It's, and it's like a, it's a, Star Wars is a medium that started, or not a medium, a, that's funny though, to say that by
become
accident.
One. kind of right? Become one.
Yeah.
But yeah, Star Wars is like a franchise that just started as this pulpy, you know, sci-fi fantasy thing,
mm-hmm.
right? That was like very kind of off the beaten path and stuff. And now it is just culture, right? It's like, it's just woven into the fabric of society.
Well, that's kind of putting it lightly, but there's a good parallel there, because Star Wars actually came about because the films of the time were either too realistic and dreary, or projecting the violence of the times in all too a realistic manner, and people were really actually getting sick of the theater until this escape came in the form of the science fiction. It allowed them to escape their everyday lives and, you know, gave way to their imagination and their fantasy and the happy endings only celluloid can deliver. And in the same way, Otaku no Video owns that.
Mm. Yeah. I mean, it definitely, the main character, Kubo, his fall into otakudom, which is arguably not super well contextualized, like, it doesn't, it has never really convinced me that he would kind of go that hard into it based on where he was in life.
Yeah.
But at least the sort of perfunctory justification for it seems to be that he's, like, kind of won over by this appeal to nostalgia. It's like, oh, these cartoons and stuff and these shows that I watched as a kid, like, oh, I can watch them again, right? Like, this return to a more innocent time.
Yeah.
Also an easier time.
Yeah, an easier time, right. Which I think is probably true for a lot of the fans, right? I mean, like, a lot of people who grew up around that time, at least in the Japanese context, it was like, I'm cribbing a little bit from an article, actually, about early Gainax stuff from Sean O'Mara on Zimmer.moe, but he described it well, I think, as, like, because of the economic situation of the time, they basically were able to have this perpetual adolescence. So it was just, like, these kids who never grew up. That you can see that in a lot of, like, writing about the time period in both English and, like, translated stuff in Japanese, because the big touch points early on, right, were Gundam and Yamato, especially the film screenings for those when they came out in, like, film compilations. And it was, like, these kids who grew up watching these things, and then everyone making it expected it was just more kids' entertainment, and then these kids kept watching them, right? And they continued to be into this stuff as they grew up.
Right.
Honestly, it's like cracking a child's book, you know, and just rereading it as an adult and seeing all that was actually written into it. There's some of that, too. Yeah.
Right, but I mean, it's interesting because Kubo comes into it backwards, right? Because I think what a lot of people did was not that they went back to things from their childhood, though I guess in some cases they probably did with stuff like Doraemon and stuff, but, like, it was that they never stopped, right? They just, they were just a child forever.
Well, I think Sean's article also points out the very good point that the generation, the sort of the Gainax generation, was the first generation in Japan to really, A, be middle class, and B, be directly influenced by anime just for anime's sake and being able to make references to that, whereas the kind of the generation before that had this, you know, different context and was, you know, basically taking the influences from culture and the war and the occupation and all that, and kind of channeling that into their creativity.
Well, and there's another part of that that's super important that he actually doesn't mention in the article, but it's the fact that, especially in, like, not at the time of like Gundam and Yamato, but as you get into the 80s, like, this was the first time that people had access to video recordings where they could go back and watch things, right? And I think that's a really important thing. Jonathan Clements talks about this in Anime History, like the ability to watch to sit at home and watch your favorite episode over and over was like a radical shift compared to it's on TV once, right? You watch it once and then you move on with your life.
Right.
You now have the ability to not move on with your life and sit there and study it and like learn everything about it and watch it forwards and backwards and frame by frame, right? Which they give some like lip service to at the beginning of Otaku no Video.
Oh, right. Yeah. Mm. Yeah. Using some of the Daikon footage, I think.
It's very self-referential, yeah. It's got, like, they show the Daikon video and say, like, look at how amazing this effects animation is. Like,
yeah. I also appreciate how much they appreciate my favorite anime, Macross. That's also...
Oh, yes.
I feel kind of like, the more I think about how this has sort of rippled down the ages, so to speak, in terms of anime culture, I kind of feel like we're now almost in this feedback loop, you know, like with anime. And like, this is me getting very meta and probably not quite on the point of the cast, but I feel like successive generations have also been influenced by anime stuff, you know, and they continue to kind of reference it in this sort of widening circle of content. But I wonder how far out, and I'm sure that there are creators that do, but I wonder how far out creators are going outside of that for some new influences and some new kind of
it's inbreeding.
Yeah,
but it's the best way to describe it, right?
Yeah.
And the inbreeding maybe kind of works okay the first time. I don't want to say inbreeding's okay, but it's like you can maybe get away with it and not have like a horrible birth defect the first time, but you're just playing those odds every time, right? Successive generations.
Eventually you're trying to burn all of Westeros down. It's awful. But I was doing some research on Toshio Okada ahead of the podcast, and in his last book he wrote, which is something like, it's something basically like Otaku wa sude ni shinderu, which means sort of like, otaku, you're already dead. And he basically, he does the thing that everybody that had like a super influential role in a pop culture moment does. They look at kind of what they've wrought, and they've sort of like criticized
for
how bad. Well, you know, it's funny. Like, and I'm only reading a review of the book. I obviously haven't read the whole book. I wish I could actually, but he kind of, you know, chastises the current generation of otaku for withdrawing even deeper into their kind of make-believe world, which is.
But
like,
he was the guy who was all about that.
He was literally the Oda King.
That
right?
was his thing.
Yeah. Like, so I kind of wonder, like...
Well, that was his thing back then. People do grow, hopefully.
Right. Yeah. Well, I mean, the guy that he is now, where he's, you know, internationally known founder of Gainax, you know, that's a different guy from the guy who is, you know, scrapping together the Daikon 3 and 4 videos. But, you know, I think it's just funny that, like, he's even kind of come back and looked at this and gone, oh, you kids and your rock and roll... It's kind of silly.
But I think there's something to be said for the fact that, like, and I'm speaking as somebody who's from, like, a newer generation of fans, there was a counterculture thing to that original generation of otaku that is not really there, right? It's not really a counterculture anymore.
Oh, no. I mean, you can go buy Sailor Moon shit at Hot Topic. That's not...
Well, I'm actually... most of this I'm talking about, like, Japanese side, but it's also somewhat true. It's less true for the U.S. The U.S. is still a bit of a counterculture, but it's becoming less so over time.
It's far less so than it used to be, I'll say that.
Right, for sure. Yeah.
Thanks, it's Crunchyroll.
Right.
Not today, Satan.
I feel like it's almost like maybe equivalent to what superheroes were before the really big boom in like superhero movies, where it was like, or even maybe a little before that, because like even before that there were superhero movies that were pretty popular, but like
Yeah.
It's kind of like, you know, people know what this is. They just, they're not, it's not, like, right in the middle of the spotlight yet.
Yeah. Hmm. Growing up, I mean, on the comic book thing, I used to get ragged on like crazy for, you know, coming to school with my freaking Death of Superman comics and, like, you know, reading them and stuff at lunch. And, you know, like, now, like, that's just, you know, everybody loves superheroes. The superhero movie now is like the equivalent of the Western movie in the 1950s. There's like a 50 billion of them every month that come out, and they're all kind of mediocre. And it's kind of crazy that we're sort of, that's the thing that the culture is kind of latched onto right now. It's really weird for me, at least. But yeah, I kind of wonder, you know, if with Okada, I wonder if he's talking about, like, Hikikomori in particular. You know,
right.
And I don't know.
I think so.
I'm reading into that a little bit, but I feel like he is.
But yeah, like, also on the subject of the counterculture thing, I think that that period in the 80s was probably the only time, or one of the few times, where anime and manga culture was particularly countercultural. Like, maybe the only other time I could think of is, like, maybe there's some periods pre-war where there was a fair amount of kind of politicized animation work and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, generally, over the long history of Japanese animation, most of the time it kind of just falls into a very standard, like, you know, following the trends kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, it doesn't have a lot of... It doesn't challenge society in a lot of ways, and, like, it kind of did at some points pre-war, and then it definitely, like, otaku culture challenged the society of the time by just saying, like, we're not going to participate in it in the way that you want us to.
Well,
right?
And that's, you know, that's a good point, Evan. And, like, if you think about 1980s Japan, where, you know, pre-bubble, they're at the height of their economic power and influence. You know, the Japanese salaryman sort of culture is a bit more... It doesn't have quite that negative connotation it has today. You know, it was much more of a, you know, this is what you do. You go and you work for a company for the rest of your life, and you work like 16-hour days, and you go drink at night with your coworkers, and you know, you do all this stuff, and that's life. And if you think about it in those terms, yeah, then the otaku culture is like a direct challenge to that in a lot of ways, because it eschews all of those things. It's like, screw work, screw all this lifetime employment and giving myself to this corporation and blah, 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 blah. And so that's a very good point. And I definitely feel like it's lost its...
But now that we say it, I'm looping back to Okada's point, and I'm like, you know what? Neat and Hikikomori stuff is also sort of that. Mm-hmm. And maybe that, especially as, like, lifetime employment and that kind of thing in Japan becomes less... realistic. There was an article recently about that, right?
Yeah.
It seems like that response starts to feel a lot more like a legitimate counterculture,
mm-hmm.
like just not participating.
Right.
Well, counterculture or excuse.
Well, and I think you could say that the neat Hikikomori phenomenon is sort of the ultimate apotheosis of what this otaku culture that's suggested at in Otaku no Video is, for good or ill, right? So, you know, those folks at least still went out, you know?
Yeah, it's a very like nihilistic response, right?
Right.
The Hikikomori thing, just shutting yourself in, not engaging in society at all.
Mm-hmm.
It's an all or nothing. It's a dismissal of everything that is simply because you cannot make it work for you,
mm-hmm.
which is ultimately very selfish, which, you know, is otakudom.
I mean, yeah, I mean, it's... Especially if you think about the fact that the Hikikomori neat phenomenon really intensified and became, well, the terms emerged for them in the aftermath of the real estate bubble and sort of the 20-plus year stagflation that Japanese society and the economy there has had to undergo.
And in that, like, you always have the result of that is, you know, when you have such a surplus, you will have art in every direction because no one literally knows where to put all their money. So it's like, oh, well, you can do this thing. Why not? Go ahead. You know, we got the funds.
Megazone 13 got made, y'all.
Or case Megazone 2-3.
Like, the real test of art, and I guess to an extended point, the real test of if you want to call it a counterculture, is if it continues despite hard times.
Mm-hmm.
Like, if it keeps true to its mantra and keeps trying to either be the same or evolve to attract more people to its cause. And I'm just not sure, mm-hmm. like, Otakudom really fits that. Because it just constantly wants to be its own thing. And it's separatist in a way. It's not necessarily counterculture. It's just protectionist.
Mm-hmm.
Mm. I think Evangelion kind of sealed the deal. It was like, all right, now this is just culture. Mm-hmm. Right?
Yeah.
And obviously it's been through ups and downs with, like, the Miyazaki murders and things like that. The Tsutomu Miyazaki murders.
Yeah.
The other Miyazaki. I'm not talking about the time when Hayao Miyazaki in the future will murder his son for making Tales from Earthsea 2.
Man. Yeah, wow. Cool.
Okay, wait, so we should... I don't know what if you had this on the list there, Ink, but like I feel like we should talk about the creators behind this, because we brought up Okada.
We
haven't really contextualized who these people are. We've kind of poked at the edges of it.
No, let's definitely do that.
The reason I really wanted you on here is because you are Trigger fanboy number one. I'm not sure why you haven't appeared in any of their short con exclusive videos yet, but you know a ton behind the studio and the fact that, you know, of course, Gainax gave rise to Trigger, and you can give probably a lot more insight into the real importance of these figures.
Possibly, yeah. Like, so, I mean, I know more about Trigger than I know about Gainax, but yeah, I do know some amount about Gainax. And like, so Okada, who we kind of mentioned, right, he was like this figure, he's written a lot about otaku culture and was a kind of like producer, co-founder of Studio Gainax, who I feel like I need to sometimes contextualize, because who knows who's listening. Gainax has made shows you might have heard of, like Neon Genesis Evangelion and Fooly Cooly and Gurren Lagann and a bunch of other things before that, including Otaku no Video, right? And it's sort of, like we said, semi-autobiographical about Gainax, but it's also strange, you guys probably took note of this, that the characters they do a lot of things that are references to Gainax, and it's like supposed to be them acting out what Gainax did, but they are also in a world in which the Gainax people and the Gainax people's like productions still exist.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
So like they create a company called Grand Prix, or GP, which is General Products, the sort of like garage kit, you know, figure manufacturing, like merchandising arm of, not, I guess it was a separate company, but eventually kind of merged into Gainax and became their merchandising arm. But they were like run kind of by the same people, right? They're like sibling companies.
Mm-hmm.
And like, you know, Grand Prix, like co-sponsors the first Wonder Carnival or right. Wonder Festival, basically, right? Which was like also same exact thing happened with General Products, but at the same time, the timeline of title cards includes Wings of Oniami's made by Gainax. The like they mention Anno at one point, right? Don't they mention his designs for Macross?
They do.
So like it's a universe in which Anno exists, but there's like all these
Is
parallels
there a universe
to...
in which Anno does not exist. That's a sad universe.
Yeah, and they don't have like it's not a one-to-one comparison. They don't have all of the major touch points of like the Gainax history, right? They don't produce a convention opening animation, for example, which would have been the big thing to include if you were doing like a one-to-one, you know, names changed but basically the same thing,
right?
Like story of Gainax, right? They start by doing, like, garage kits and then do anime, which I don't think is the way that Gainax did it.
Oh, yeah. I know that in The Portrait of Otaku, most of the guys that are being interviewed are connected to or are Gainax staffers, including the aforementioned Hideaki Anno. He's the computer gamer. He's, like, one of the very last ones they do.
Is he?
Yeah.
I wasn't sure if that was him. It didn't sound like his voice, because he's got that, like, weird nasally voice, and the guy doesn't seem to have that.
Yeah. Well, it's...
Aren't they all, like, screamed?
That one isn't, I think, the computer gamer guy.
Yeah,
because he's kind of obsessing over this girl who's kind of, like, a girl that... So Gainax did a hentai game.
They did a couple hentai games.
Yeah, and so that's sort of that was sort of like one of the ways he was connected to that project or something like that.
It's when they're showing a character playing Cybernetic High School, which is the game where you have to answer these quiz questions when talking to these girls, and then if you answer the questions right, their clothes come off.
Yeah.
How do you know so much about this game?
I was looking it up before the before the show. And actually, I think it might have been in the Zimmer.moe article, which is what I was reading. But I'm not 100% sure about the order in terms of, like, I certainly, general products is not something that I'm an expert on by any measure, right? I know more about Gainax than I do about general products.
The details are all there, though. Like, the big bullet points, you know, they did garage kits, they did animation.
Yeah.
GP stands for the same GP, or it's...
Right,
it's very close to the GP that was actually in existence. It was a forerunner to Gainax, and then, you know, later in Otaku No Video, they talk about GX, Giant X, which is
Giant X,
basically Gainax. You know, it's like, oh come on, guys! Like, how close can you get? And I think at some point they were just like trying to play the game of how close can we get to like using real life crap without actually using real life stuff. You know, like,
well, it's weird though, right?
That's half the fun of it, though.
Because the OVA is full of real, like, very direct references to real like anime productions and things, right? I mean, they say Macross in it. They have a lot of like stuff that would not fly today. Like, where they just have the art, they have the actual poster for like Castle Cagliostro or something, like a bunch of examples. They have it's like a who's who when you're looking around in the background, right? It's like, at one point the wall has a Castle Cagliostro poster, then like a year or so later it's got like Gosh the cellist or whatever, it's got like Dirty Pear, right?
There's the Do You Remember Love poster for sure.
Yeah.
I mean, it's... Well, and I mean, like, the parts where they're talking about Macross, I mean, they're straight up using, like, Macross...
Right.
Like, designs, Macross... Like, I think some of that is, like, damned footage from the movie. Like, it looks perfect. As someone who's seen that movie a couple times, I mean, like, I was having trouble... I would, like, pause and look at it and really look at it. And, you know, I unfortunately can't pull up Do You Remember Love and, like, look at it at the same time. But man, it seemed like they just straight up lifted it. Like, you know, maybe they, like, changed a couple of colors somewhere so they could get away with it. I don't know. But it was a very faithful reproduction.
I mean, in terms of staff, I mean, I guess I'm trying to think of, like, what else I have to say on that. Because, I mean, the big thing is just the point that, it is this group of people from Gainax kind of telling their story, but also just telling the story of otaku in general, right? Mm-hmm. Of this culture that they were a big part of that was, like, you know, how they made their way in the world. And I think it serves a certain purpose having it not just be about Gainax. Like, that detachment makes it, I don't know, like, these characters are the otaku everyman or something, as opposed to being just Gainax, like, the real people who actually did it.
It can be both. I mean, because what you're doing is you're pushing, like, the idea of the everyman, but then linking the idea of the everyman to your own company and saying, no, everyone should fall in love with what our company is, and what we are is the company that constantly pushes boundaries as fans for the fans.
There's something to be said for it as an ad for Gainax.
Exactly. Yeah, definitely. Exactly. Because Gainax is over the top. It's ridiculous. It's awesome. It's what anime should be.
And despite, like, all of the like negativity that they kind of strategically place throughout, like, about the fandom, you can make the argument that it is very much a love letter to the fandom that sort of has one eye open, right? Like the animated story of it is very idealistic and hopeful, and, you know, we're gonna start a production company, you know, and like. Mm-hmm. Do it with,
a year later. We have happen. A 40-story tower for our production company.
Yeah, I mean, it has this sort of like love letter, whimsy kind of thing to it that, like you guys are saying, kind of goes back to Gainax and their style in general. Did anybody like just maybe it's just me, but did anybody watch this and finally see the drill at the end and go, oh, okay?
Wait, which thing are you saying okay about? Because we might not be thinking of the same thing.
So at the very end...
there's the drill on the rocket at the end.
The
I know
the
scene
the
you're
rocket,
talking about.
And they go up into space, and, you know, it's the drill piercing the heavens, literally, you know.
Oh. Mm.
And
I wouldn't necessarily draw that line so strongly, because I don't think Anno or any of the, or really anybody at the, who is like involved, actually, I don't know how involved Anno was, but I don't think a lot of the people involved in Otaku no Video were really coming up with the ideas for Gurren Lagann.
Well, like, yeah, no. I don't know that they, like, sat down. Like, I don't think they sat down in 1991 and said, okay, we're going to do these 17 anime, and at some point we're going to do this one with the drill. So we're going to work that in here. I don't think that. I just think it was interesting to see that kind of, that show
imagery.
Up. And
yeah.
That imagery. And it's sort of like that thing, you know, you make stuff, you make a, you know, any art, you make enough of it, and you start kind of reflecting back and calling back on your own stuff before you even realize you're doing it sometimes.
I guess what I'm saying, though, is that, like, there's a bit of, like, a bias that fans sometimes have when looking at this stuff to attach a little too much significance to the studio.
That is a very fair point.
So, like, I don't think Gainax is one singular entity that referenced Drills and then referenced Drills again. I think it's more likely that both of them were referencing Drills in, like 70s robot shows and tokusatsu shows independently of each other, because there's such a wide gap in time and who actually worked on them.
That's true.
But a
that's
drill
a
literally piercing the heavens. Like, yeah. Even if it wasn't, like, intentional, like, there was definitely a callback in Gurren Lagann to that. And I don't know whether that was their source of inspiration or it's just something, like, in the back of their subconscious after having watched it or worked with those people.
It's possible. I just know, like, that's when you start to get into, like, the trigger zone. Mm-hmm. And I know that, like, that generation, that trigger generation is, like, it's just a very different group of people from the people who were, like, doing early Gainax work. They, ooh, like, the main through line is that Imaishi was very inspired by Anno and learned from him. And there's a couple other people who, like, kind of were mentored by Anno or other people, but they're, like, a disjoint kind of generation that was not, like, part of the same, you know, part of the same, like, attitudes and stuff of the early Gainax crew.
Evan, would you therefore say that Otaku no Video is the highway to the trigger zone?
All right. Get out of here. No, the real highway to the trigger zone is, it's like two shows. It's Evangelion and Fooly Cooly, by the way. Because it's like, Eva is where, like, there's kind of like these two main generations of trigger people. Some of them got their start on Eva or, like, did a bunch of work on Eva. It's like Imaishi did work on Eva. And then, like, some of the younger people got their big start on Fooly Cooly. And so between those two shows is where, like, that's where the trigger generation got started. And yeah, ended up making, like, Gurren Lagann and Panty and Stocking.
I like to think of trigger as the continuation of the role, you know, Otaku no Video.
Sure.
Has
yeah.
Rise and fall, and then rise and fall, or the rise. And then, so there's another fall after the movie, and then triggers the other rise after that.
Maybe, yeah, you could see that. Maybe Kara is the more direct example.
Yeah.
Where it's like, they have, like, all right, I gotta leave, but I'm gonna start another studio that basically does the same stuff.
Trigger is definitely, like, the spiritual successor, I think, in a lot of ways, to what we think of.
It's hard to say. Like, it's them and Kara, and they both do some stuff that feels like spiritual successor to Gainax stuff.
Yeah, I don't know what Kara does besides the Evangelion movies, but I mean,
Animator Expo and Dragon Dentist are two big things that they've done.
Okay. Yeah. It feels like Trigger's got the same kind of moxie, I guess, you know, to bring back a term from the 1930s. I don't know. It just feels like that to me, like their sensibility. Yeah.
I was going to say, with the drill on the rocket, the first thing I thought was the daikon thing.
Oh, yeah.
Right? Because it's kind of shaped like the daikon radish from, like, the daikon animations.
Yeah, that is true. What else do we want to say about Otaku no Video in this whole... And I kind of like how this discussion, because it befits this piece of art, it's a very meta discussion in a lot of ways. What else do we want to say about the staff or the animation itself?
I definitely had thoughts on, like, the production itself and how well it works.
Yeah.
Watching it now. I don't know about you guys, but, like,
what were some of the points of production that actually particularly struck you?
Well, So I actually don't think, you know, like I said, I didn't think it like super ages well as a story, and I think it's just like there's not much going on in the story, right? It's a super simplistic story. The characters are kind of fun, but the arc doesn't, it's not very exciting, right? Like there's the one big sort of turnabout or two, I guess, where it's kind of like, all right, you know, Kubo gets removed from the company, and then he comes back and wins it all back. But it's like, there's not a lot of tension to it, right? You're kind of like, all right, well, that worked out. Like, there's not a point at the end where you think that he might lose it all again or something, right? It's just not very, very well structured as a story, I don't think.
Oh,
right?
From a narrative perspective, yeah. This thing's a pile of shit. And I think it always has an end. Like, you know, like it just, yeah, like it's, sort of has this amusing charm because you kind of can come into it and be like, you know, it's just a super meta show. Back in a day where meta wasn't even a term you could use, it was just like but if I'm brand new to it, I'm coming up to it, watching it for the first time, I'm like, what the fuck is this, you know? Like, yeah
it serves much better as like being, like you said, meta, like being where the subject isn't really the story, it's just sort of the stuff around it, right?
Yeah.
Like, the story is just there to deliver you the rest of that stuff.
It's kind of all the subtext around the story that you're picking up. The people who wrote it, like, didn't try to hide very well, like, what their real feelings were. And, like, they just kind of put it out there.
Yeah, it's there to, like, make a point, kind of.
That's
and
exactly
I think
it.
That I was going to say, like, you know, who wrote the screenplay, right? It's Okada, who's... I haven't read a ton of his writing, right? But I mean, he's like a nonfiction writer. He writes about otaku culture.
Mm-hmm.
He's not like, to my knowledge, he's not somebody with a ton of credits for writing, you know, fictional narratives.
No.
He's also credited on screenplay for like Gunbuster. That's the only big thing. And Gunbuster has like three other script writers attached in various forms. So I wonder how much of that he even wrote, right? Like,
right.
Anno wrote the last two episodes, and I'm sure, despite not being credited for the rest of it, he wrote, like, probably parts of the other ones.
Mm.
Who knows? So, like, I think Okada probably just can't tell a good story. He's just not that good at it.
Or he's really good at telling a non-direct story. Because that's really what this is. If you're writing an entire movie to maintain viewer focus on the meta as opposed to the actual plot, that's actually talent and technique. That's what nonfiction writers do.
I think that's giving him too much credit, though.
Yeah, I think Okada is good at capturing.
I think he's good at
capturing the feeling of being an otaku, and then the as a story, it doesn't work, but it does work as a way of capturing that feeling, right?
Because that works on a kind of an emotional level,
yeah.
I think, for just about anybody that watches it, except that one person, which, you know, whatever.
Well, what did you guys think about the animation?
Kind of average for the time, honestly. Like, except for, like, the parts where that's not entirely fair, because, like, just the normal kind of, like, you know, here's Kubo running around doing things and saying things. I mean, like, that wasn't, like, particularly, you know, extraordinary to me in itself, but the way they sort of nested the different animation and art styles in there, like, there's the one scene that sticks out in my mind where it's early... Yeah, it's early in the first volume, and he's gone to the university's like cultural festival or whatever, and then he's surrounded by cosplayers, and it's kind of clever the way they do it. Like, all of the cosplayers have a very distinct look that sort of suggests like they are literally that character, and the art styles are like very, very faithful to like the characters they represent. You know, or at least that it struck me that way. So like there's some real clever things that they do in terms of like paying homage to all the other works, because I think when you see those works, like the poster for You Do You Remember Love, I mean, like, they had to draw that, right? And that thing looks like perfect. That I think was really cool, but like there was nothing that jumped out in my mind. And now, granted, I appreciate animation, and you know, but I am not as technically as schooled in it as certainly you, Evan, or like some of our other listeners. But there was nothing in there that jumped out to me that as particularly extraordinary about the quality of the animation in an overall sense compared to other things of its age.
I'd mostly agree. Yeah.
Do you think they were using that for a purpose, like saying, like, okay, don't concentrate on our story, concentrate on the focus of the story, which is everything referenced within it?
I might say it was a consequence of the setting itself. If you look at early Gainax work, frankly, I don't think, maybe some hardcore Gainax fans will disagree with me, I don't think that, like, character acting was their strength. Right? Mm. Like, they were really good at science fiction stuff and, you know, robot animation and effects animation, but they just, you know, the characters had enough personality, but they don't really, they don't have the sort of life to them that I'd say, frankly, you know, that later Gainax generation was able to add, right? Like, the, like, you know, watch something like Fooly Cooly or Gurren Lagann. That group of people started to, I think, have a lot more, like, you know, acting chops to them. So I think that when you set a story in the real world, it, you know, even the Gainax animators are only going to be able to get so far with it.
That was kind of my reaction. Like, as soon as I rewatched this, I was like, so this is Gainax does slice of life.
Yeah, slice of nerd life.
Yeah.
The only chance they have to shine is really when they go into their self-referential material. Mm-hmm. And when they can play with their own material, when they can play with the, you know, the sci-fi or the boob jiggling or whatever have you.
Yeah, yeah. The
that's when they start to have fun with the animation, and that's
the,
when it
the Misty May transformation is really good.
That is
all that stuff.
That is
yeah,
great. Yeah. As soon as they can get away from that's a very good point, guys. As soon as they get away from the realism, their technical skills become a lot more apparent. That's true. And y'all both explained that much more articulately than what I was saying. And like I think I was picking up on the same thing.
You know, it's interesting, though. So this is part of one of the things I was interested in talking about is, to me at least, there's a distinct difference between episode 1 and 2 in terms of the acting and animation.
Oh, I think it's a bit better in 2, don't you think?
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah.
Like, 2 has a lot more personality. There's just sort of more acting. Characters have more exaggerated expressions and, like, little accents and things when they move. Like, there's a scene where, near the end, where Tanaka, Kubo's friend, is, you know, he's kind of, like, waiting online to buy some garage kits or something. Mm-hmm. And he kind of runs away from Kubo, and Kubo runs after him. And both of them are really kind of springy, the way
yeah.
they move.
Yeah.
So I was looking into it because I was like, there's got to be a reason for this. This is like a big difference, and I don't think it's just like more money. It's a different style of animation. It's a lot more kind of tamped down in the first episode. And I think it's because they had a different animation director, if you look at the credits. I fixed this on Anime News Network because they had it wrong. So the first episode is Takeshi Honda, and the one for episode 2 is Hidenori Matsubara, who we have interviewed, I believe, at Otakon. He's going to be at Otakon this year, and he's super good. And so episode 2's got that more, you know, slightly more exaggerated character animation, which I thought worked pretty well. It's like, I felt like it needed more of that in the first episode, because, like, you know, especially having watched some Blue Fire, as Vicky calls it, Aoi Hono.
Yeah.
Like, the, you know, that's a show where the characters act like anime characters in this exaggerated way to show how they see the world through the lens of anime. And episode 2 of Otaku no Video has a little bit of that, and episode 1 doesn't have very much of it. It's only got a tiny bit.
I think there's a reason for that, though. Like, if you really want to overread into it, which is what we do. Throughout the first part of this OVA, like, they are not people seeing the world through animation. They are people who love animation and love seeing it. But in the second part, they are the people producing it. Thus, they are seeing the world through it because they have to devise marketing strategy and, you know, target their audience and know who they're selling to, what they're selling, etc. So that divide in, you know, observation and viewpoints, it kind of makes sense to me.
Yeah, I wonder how intentional it was, though. Like, I almost want to ask. I want to ask, like, Matsubara or something, because both he and Honda worked on both episodes, and I wonder if it was literally just they got Honda for the first episode, and then for the second episode he was busy, and so they could only have him do one or two shots, and then they just had Matsubara direct, right? Mm-hmm. Like, it might have just been something as simple as that.
entirely
like
possible.
You said, the writing is not the strong suit, so I doubt my own hypothesis there. But I think it works as at least like Death of the Author thing.
Okay, since you mentioned Aoi no Hana a moment ago, Evan, for our listeners, tell them about Aoi no Hana real quick.
Aoi Hono, or Blue Blazes, or Blue Fire, which is the official translation on Viki, is a Japanese drama about... technically, the main character is a guy named... Well, his name is whatever, something Hono, but he is a roughly fictionalized version of Kazuhiko Shimamoto, who's the manga artist who made Blazing Transfer Student, is what people sometimes know him for, and he also made this manga... Aoi Hono, right? And then the manga got turned into a drama. And it's basically about him going to the Osaka University of the Arts, I think it's called, where he was classmates with Hideaki Anno, Hiroyuki Yamaga, Takami Akai, and a bunch of other folks who ended up being involved in Gainax. So Okada is in it. There's a couple other major figures. Takeda, I think, who's one of the other guys who like co-founded and you know helped start up Gainax. And so according to Yamaga in the interview that I did with him that is up on anigamers.com, most of that show is and most of that manga is extremely accurate to the events that actually happened at that time. So it's kind of a good follow-up thing to check out if you're interested in this OVA, because it tells the slightly more real but still fictionalized version of like the same kind of events.
Something else I wanted to jump back to, Ink, that like, and this ties it back to the earlier conversation, I think, but when you said that Otaku no Video was Gainax's slice of life show, I immediately thought in my mind, oh shit, Shirobako is this generation's Otaku no Video. Discuss.
That's an entire other podcast.
And I don't think it's an entirely accurate analogy, but I think there's some discussion to be had there, I think. I don't know.
Okay, I'm just going to throw some shade on Shirobako for a second.
Wait. Okay, we're going to do this. We're going to do this podcast. We're going to invite Miles and Evan to guest on it.
In a steel cage death
match. Oh, boy. Yes. Look, I'm just going to say, Otaku no Video and Shirobako both, in many ways, sugarcoat the experience of being involved in this stuff. Though I would say that Otaku no Video has enough self-awareness to say, like, but sometimes it does kind of suck, and Shirobako lacks that awareness.
Oh no, I'm slightly late to a meeting.
Yeah.
Darn.
Yeah. I
this doesn't have repercussions.
At the risk of pre-declaring myself Team Evan in that debate, I think I agree with you, Evan. Shirobako, as much as I love it, like, as a big love letter to anime itself, like, yeah, boy, God, it's like the Candyland version of the hell those people go through to make these shows we love. But anyway, I just wanted to get that out there. What else about the production itself, guys, before we move on to our entire two Twitter questions?
And those are the big things that I noticed. It is, oh, right, I mean, yeah, it like you said, it's fairly standard. It doesn't, not a lot sticks out, but it's worth noting that the designer is one of my favorite character designers, Kenichi Sonoda, who did Bubblegum Crisis and
okay.
Death with Cats and a bunch of other stuff.
So I'm not crazy.
Yeah, it's him.
I was trying to find him like credited somewhere, you know, like I'm like, and he probably is if I like go back and slow down and like look at the credits like on the disc, but you know, it's not anywhere I was looking, and I'm looking at all those designs and I'm like, God damn it, that's Sonoda. I'm not crazy.
Sonoda does the, those like the blinder hair. That's a tell for him. Like some other designers do it, but it's a very Sonoda design.
His eyes have a very distinct kind of.
Yeah, and again, like, episode 2, they look so much better when Matsubara is doing the corrections on him than when Honda is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Kenichi Sonoda is one of my favorite character designers. Him and Haruhiko Mikimoto are probably, like, my two favorites.
I really can't think of anything else that I'd want to point for the discussion.
Okay, well, going down to our Twitter questions, we've got two, like I said. First one is from a friend of the show, Vinny. Vinny Avrello, it's at Vinny AVEAGC. He's been on the show before. Has he? Has he been on the show? No, he's going to be on the show. I've been on All Geeks Considered. Great show. Please go check that out. That's, you know, insert plug. His question is, what rides would you include in your amusement park? Evan, what rides would you include in your amusement park? Your otaku land.
Well, I gotta go for the standard stuff, the standard Evan stuff, which would mean, let's see, there's gotta be a ride that takes you through hell in Inferno Cobb. You see all the sort of denizens of hell, including Inferno Cobb's grandma and probably, like, Hellfire Boy. So that's one I'd put that ride in.
I've got questions though. Is that hell ride like, you know, are you in a carriage? Are
you? I'm not a big amusement park guy, so I mean, like, I don't know. Sure, it's like it's a small world after all, but you're in hell instead. You're in a boat.
Yeah, in Inferno Cop hell, which might actually make that kind of cool.
It's a good way of controlling their rate of exposure to that world. So yeah.
Let's see. Man, this is tough, because I didn't read the questions beforehand, so that makes it more tough, because I'm dumb.
I would, well, let me give you a little help. I would be, yeah. if I was walking around in Evan's otaku world, I would be astonished if I did not get the opportunity to ride a TQ ride of some kind.
Oh, there you go. That's a good one. the TQ ride is it's just a normal roller coaster, but it's 6 times the speed.
And maybe you get to listen to the theme song on loop as you go.
And as is the case with the actual Take You show, if you slow it all the way down, it's just an episode of Berserk, also directed by Shinya Itagaki.
That's awesome.
Jared?
Okay, obviously, some sort of Macross ride. I would probably, my design committee would probably have to prevent me from doing every Macross show. And where Macross Zero would be just a burned down roller coaster, it'd be more like an art exhibit. But definitely some sort of Macross ride where you're flying around the Valkyrie. Beyond that, probably some sort of Fist in the North Star ride that is just Kenshiro walking, and you're just walking with Kenshiro, and he's on the way.
Oh, is that the sequel to Sleeping with Hinako?
Just the ending of the Hulk. Yeah.
Oh my god, that's basically it. I think that's mine. Ink, how about you?
Okay. I want like a centrifuge where you are strapped to a cone that is the drill boring through planets, but there are these rounded, non-piercing things that go over your back and flesh on the outside of the column as you are rotating through it, so you constantly feel the tension with the rock you're boring through. So you are the drill, but you don't like being the drill.
What also, show are you doing here? Is this Gurren Lagann?
That's like the most technically accurate description of a Gurren Lagann kind of reference I've ever heard.
Thank you.
I thought so, but it was very like arcane.
I think Ink just pulled out his damn blueprints he's got from the ride and just started going through it.
There's two more. There's Agent Orange, Clockwork Orange.
Orange.
Where you? Okay, so you step into a Clockwork Orange situation. You subject yourself to having your eyelids pried wide open, and all you watch is teen love films with overdramatic plot lines for like.
So, Ink, you know we're talking about our designs for an amusement park, not your designs for hell, right? Like.
Yes, but this is for, you know, Schoenfreud for it. Fans. So you step into this, you subject yourself to it, and then there's tear gas placed in the chamber at random moments just to choke you and make all the more tears. Lastly is the conveyor out of the amusement park, where you are literally just chained amongst your fellow otaku to a slow-moving conveying sidewalk that moves like half an inch a second.
So to simulate like a convention line, basically, man, no one's going to come to your theme park, dude.
I don't expect them.
Yeah, my favorite part about conventions is the line, so I'll be there on day one.
Yeah. Oh my god. Okay.
I didn't say my amusement park was for the people. I, you know, that's for me. I want to stand watch on videos watching the people.
If you love suffering and you want to subject yourself to something like the 99 Buddhist Hells or whatever, go to Ink's theme park. The second question we've got is from Josh Dunham of Wave Motion Cannon fame. who is probably Kubo, I think. But this sort of answers, that's sort of an answer to his question, I guess. What character do you find the most personally relatable in Otaku no Video?
Evan?
I don't know if I actually find any of them in particular super relatable, but it might be Kubo just because he's a little bit of a Ryaju, at least at the beginning, and I can sympathize with that. Also, I dressed up as him for a, it was an 80s-themed holiday party or some other party at Crunchyroll. It's like one of the company parties, and I was like, I need to make sure that I don't show up in some basic-ass 80s costume. It's got to be an anime costume. And so I scrounged up, like, you know, some denim stuff to dress up as him from, like, the opening credits.
Scrounged up some denim stuff. Man, you do know how much I have that stuff I have in my closet.
Yeah, that trend lasted all the way to the mid-90s. But, yeah, that's actually pretty awesome. Ink, how about you? What character would you find the most personally relatable?
You know, sadly, after how many years it's been since my viewing of this OAV, the one thing that stuck with me through all that time has been that one fake interview with the guy who records everything on VHS tapes and wants, like, the perfect library.
Oh, I didn't even think about the Portrait of an Otaku guys. Because I also definitely relate to him.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, I'll go and then you can come back. The reason why I buy physical media and keep it around is because I want to show it to other people. Mm. And you can't always do that via streaming service because who knows who has what kind of internet connection that can support bandwidth or whatever. But, you know, odds are they have some sort of device that can play a DVD. But, you know, I love building a library to introduce more people to the things I love. So, you know, I have this ever-expanding wall of cartoons on DVD and Blu-ray, and that's what I kind of want to be, is I just want to keep cataloging and purveying to people and keep spreading this.
I think for me, it's probably the guy who was their expert on science fiction, like, trivia stuff, even though I'm not, like, some great master of science fiction trivia. Only in very limited circumstances. But the fact that he's sort of segued, like, easily from, like, talking about, like Japanese anime sci-fi trivia to, like, Star Trek trivia and then, like, back again. Like I kind of feel like, you know, I am a bit of a jack-of-all-trades nerd person. You know, I mean, anime is a big, 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 big part of that for me. But I like things outside of it, so I guess of all the ones, I didn't find any of them terribly relatable, but I think if I have to like really like focus on one, I think it's that guy and then the Portrait of the Otaku guy who's like the closet cosplayer that is a computer programmer working on like Microsoft money or whatever. You know? Like that guy, because I you know, as someone who is in corporate America and in the tech side of that, actually working in a financial technology company, like it's that hit very close to home. I'm like, oh man, that dude's kind of like that dude's kind of in a similar spot to me, except, you know, I kind of openly talk about how I'm a nerd. So I guess probably that guy from the Portrait of the Otaku guy.
You took the words out of my mouth because I was just thinking of him and I was going to loop back to it. He is probably tied with the guy who they have to chase down on the street for my two favorite portraits of an otaku.
Yes.
But, like, obviously, I'm a programmer, and so is he, right? And so there's that connection. But I just really connect with the fact that he's trying to hide his power level, but once you get far
so
enough,
hard.
Right? Like, well, once you push far enough and you're like, no, tell me about your anime stuff. He pulls out the Char helmet and quotes Char. Like, it's perfect. That's me.
Yeah.
That's how I am. Yeah. It's like, at work, I'm like, oh, I like anime. Yeah. And then, like, somebody wants, like, they, like, start talking to me about it. I'm like, are you ready? Are you ready for what you're getting yourself into?
You pull a Son Goku on him, and you're like, oh, I was just hiding my true power and, like, bust out with, like, the full knowledge.
Yeah, it's actually, if I can make a slight digression for a funny story, I was at like some coffee shop, and I was wearing like my blackjack shirt that I have, and the like barista was like, "Oh, is that what is that?" I was like, "Oh, it's like a Japanese comic thing." It was like what I usually answer, right? Just like try to just make it as basic as possible so that they don't have to know more than they want to know, right? And she had like a Pokemon shirt on, but I was like, whatever. Like people like Pokemon. And then she's like, "Oh, like a manga?" And I was like, yeah. She's like, what's it called? I'm like, oh boy. It's like I'm trying to hide the power level, and then it ends up like she just keeps asking, and it's like, oh, she and her boyfriend watch One Punch Man all the time, and they're giant anime fans. So I was like, oh, okay. But it was like I was like trying to make sure that the power level didn't get out the entire time.
Like in your mind, you're busy steadily trying to hold back the gates of knowledge because you right. You have like you have your entire data log on Blackjack like ready to go.
Right, but it's like, you know, when I've had people do that at like the grocery store, like the cashier is like, "Oh, it's a cool shirt. What's that from?" And I'm like, "It's a Japanese comic." And they're like, "Cool." And it's like, "Great."
Yeah.
Didn't go further than I needed to.
I do that exact same thing if like D&D ever comes up. I'm like, "Yeah, I play D&D. Yeah, it's good." Right. And I'm like, I can get into, "Well, you know, there's Spelljammer and that was released back in 1991 and all, you know, I mean, you know, and I can do that, but I don't want to hurt them and I don't want to scare
exactly.
them off, you know."
Yeah. So you got to hold back the power level, right? Cuz you don't know your own strength.
You do. It's, you know, I'm just like Piccolo, dude. If I throw off that hat, that like hat and that cloak, I'm ready. Like it's on. But anyway,
you may have to hold back the power level because you might blow their minds.
I might. You know, I start talking about, you know, 8 hit dice creatures and stuff, and you know, challenge ratings, and people tend to run away. Wisely. Okay. So. Yeah, Josh, thank you for your question. I did, you know, seriously, Kubo did remind me of Josh, like, and his passion for anime and his dreams of you know, giving all of his soul to anime. But that was funny that he asked that question. All right, so let's talk about where we can find you on the internet and beyond, Evan.
You can find me on twitter.com. I'm @VamptVo, VamptVo, and I tweet on there about anime and manga and video games and a bunch of politics stuff now, because we live in a very political time period, so get ready for that. And I am the editor-in-chief of AnnieGamers.com, which is the host of this very podcast. I have been writing a lot of stuff on there, including some reviews. I just did a review of In This Corner of the World, which is premiering on August 11th at Otakon, so like this week. And it is a phenomenal movie. Please read my review and please go watch that movie. It's really, really good. It has Hidenori Matsubara as the animation director and character designer, I think. So speaking of him on Otaku No Video. And I'm hosting the Annie Gamers podcast every 2 weeks. We're on a little bit of a break for Otakon, and we'll be right back like within a week or two. That's with David Estrella, QX20XX, another Annie Gamers compatriot.
Wait, I don't recognize that name.
What?
I don't recognize that name. Isn't it @?
Yeah, you're right. @QX20XX. My bad. You have to spell it, the @. And I'm writing for Otaku USA magazine, as usual, so I have a bunch of stuff in there. I don't remember what is... I reviewed The Dragon Dentist, which we mentioned a little bit earlier. So check that out in an upcoming issue, and not totally confirmed yet, but maybe look out for me on the Anime News Network coming up in a little bit.
Oh, yeah. Breaking news on Otaku No Radio, cue the R&B air horns. Awesome. Thank you. Ink, where can we find you?
You can see my fingerprints on all the works that are being published on Anagamers. I am in the background editing and manipulating and suggesting things for that site. I also coordinate the 3-episode test column, which was just published about a few weeks ago with only me, because only I am watching anime this season, and because I forgot to contact Alex Osborne. You can also find me on fandompost.com. I just had a 10 Years Later article published on Masaki Yuasa's Happy Machine. I am also in the pages of Otaku USA magazine, not the most recent one because I replied too late, but in the upcoming Anime USA issue. And that's about it. Oh, I can also be found on the Taiku podcast as their official bad sports anime commentator.
A job only you can do.
Is that bad anime about sports or anime about bad sports?
Yes.
Bad anime about sports.
Okay.
And bad sports, Keijo.
Keijo is awesome.
We have to check that box every episode, bitch about Keijo. And I, Jared Nelson, you can find me on Twitter at Save versus Jared. You can normally also find me writing for Anagamers and Wave Motion Cannon. I'm taking a bit of a break from that right now. Looking to get back into that very soon, though. Yeah, that's it for me. So I guess for Evan, for Ink, for myself, thank you guys so much for listening, and we will see you next time.
Toodle-pip.
See ya. Thanks for having me.
For some reason, when I heard Miyazaki Murders, I just instantly went Masterpiece Theater in my brain, and I'm thinking, like, Miyazaki as, like, Hercule Poirot is going to be going around solving murders, which I kind of want now.
He doesn't have a dog or anything. He has, like, he has the sheep or, like, the goats from Heidi
Oh, God.
Instead.
Oh, man.